From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Nobody is listening to your telephone calls.
So said President Obama on June 7th, the day after Britain's Guardian newspaper released documents about the National Security Agency's surveillance program. Here are some excerpts from NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden's statement about the leaks.
Even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded, and the storage capability of these systems increases every year. It's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call, and then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made. The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change.
And here's more from President Obama's June 7th answers to questions about surveillance.
By sifting through this so-called metadata, they may identify potential leads with respect to folks who might engage in terrorism. If the intelligence community then actually wants to listen to a phone call, they've got to go back to a federal judge, just like they would in a criminal investigation. So I want to be very clear. Some of the hype that we've been hearing over the last day or so, nobody's listening to the content of people's phone calls.
Confused about what's really going on with the NSA and government? Well, let's start with a little history. In 2003, I talked with journalist James Bamford, who'd just come out with a book about the NSA. Back then, he said the general public didn't know much about the National Security Agency by design.
NSA has a policy they call their policy of anonymity, and the whole idea is to try to keep as low a profile as possible. When I did The Puzzle Palace, my first book on NSA, I did a TV show with Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey, who was on the show to talk about the economy. But in the car going over there, he said, "What's your book about?" And I said, "It's about NSA, the National Security Agency." And he said, "What's that?" So this is a Rhodes Scholar senator from New Jersey who I had explained what NSA was.
I want to repeat Senator Bradley's question then. What is the National Security Agency?
Well, it's the largest intelligence agency in the world, and its job is basically to eavesdrop on communications all over the world, to become America's big ear and listen to what people say different parts of the world, and if it's encrypted, to break those codes.
How is it done? Have they been successful?
Well, they were very successful during the Cold War because they spent almost 50 years focusing on one target, the Soviet Union and its satellite countries, basically. And it did a very good job. It could tell any time a plane took off in Russia, any time a door of a silo opened, they would know it immediately. But the problem is, once the Cold War ended, that technology to be able to do that didn't translate very well into tracking down terrorists. It's one thing to keep track of information in and out of a Soviet airbase or a Soviet naval port or a Soviet army command. It's a different thing entirely because those things are always pretty much fixed. You always know where it's going to be.
And they're big enough targets.
And they're big targets, and they always speak in the same basic frequencies, the same communications channels. It gets to be very routine. It's very different when you're tracking down a handful of people running around the world who don't communicate very much, and when they do, it could be from Kenya or it could be from southern Florida.
Well, also technology has changed in the last few years, hasn't it? The cell phone technology is so much more difficult to crack.
Well, digital technology is, yeah. It's information is sent along in packets, so it's not as though you could just listen to two ends of a conversation very easily. And at the same time, there's such a vast amount of information out there that hadn't been out there before. And it floods the ether with all this information. So you've got so much more out there.
10 years later, with a vast majority of Americans on cell phones and spending hours every day online, there's that much more information out there for the government to keep its eyes or ears on. One of the questions from 2003 that still lingers today is how the data that's collected through so-called listening posts is being used. Here's what Bamford said back then.
If you have all these listening posts and are each picking up about 2 million pieces of communications a day, you've got to get it down where a human being can actually read something and understand it. You know, the Secretary of State may be able to read 3 messages intercepted messages or three NSA reports during a normal day. But the point is, you've got to narrow all that down to a small enough amount that human beings can understand it and issue a report, and other people can actually read and understand those reports.
Now, they do, I assume, in looking at all of these communications that take place, they are looking at American citizens. They are looking at American correspondence.
Well, it gets more complicated than that. Actually, anybody in the United States is called a U.S. person, and they're not allowed to eavesdrop on a U.S. person.
Does that mean they don't do it?
No. What it means is that they can't do it without getting a warrant, and they have to get a warrant from a court, which is a secret court. Very few people have ever heard of this, but there's a secret court system that was set up. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISA Court. It was set up in 1978, and NSA has to get a warrant from that court to eavesdrop on a U.S. person. The problem is, since 1978, that court has never turned the government down on a request. And if it did, there is a thing known as the Foreign Intelligence Appeals Court, which has a unique distinction of being the only court in the United States never to have heard a case.
This gets scarier and scarier when you look at it, because it's an agency that can eavesdrop, but only if they ask a secret court, which doesn't have to tell us that it met, except that there's an appeals court which has never been appealed to.
That's right.
And we can't look at what the records are?
That's right. It's a secret agency that goes to a secret court and who issues secret authorizations. That's right. That's the truth. I mean, I'm not making this up. It's all real. And to give the other side a little bit, the Justice Department does look very closely at some of these requests that come in and doesn't approve every one. And the Justice Department has turned down requests in the past. The only ones that they have turned down are the ones that have become controversial. They actually turned down one for Zachariah Massawi. So it isn't totally cut and dry, but when it does get to the court has never turned the government down on a request.
That was part of my conversation with journalist James Bamford 10 years ago, after he released his book about the NSA called Body of Secrets. If you want to hear more of that conversation, find the link at ttbook.org.
I am the eye in the sky.
To help us understand what the recent leaks about the program have revealed, Ann Strainchamps called Susan Landau. She is an independent scholar and computer scientist who's written about cybersecurity, privacy, and public policy.
Susan, one of the things I keep wondering lately is why, when stories about federal surveillance have been popping up for the past decade or so, why people seem to be so much more concerned now than they have been in the past? I mean, what's different about these documents that have been leaked by Edward Snowden?
Well, the striking thing to me is the first set of documents, the documents about the metadata. We had no idea that the telephone companies were handing over that metadata to the government daily, and that is something that should have been discussed. What we had was a secret interpretation of a law, and that's tantamount to a secret law. But then the question comes, why is the metadata so important? And the answer is that with cell phones, we leak where we are and what we do every hour of the day. So you call from an oncologist's office, and depending on the kind of location device in your cell phone, it may be visible that you're actually calling from the oncologist's office, or you're calling from the mammogram unit at the hospital, or you call from the church on the evening when they have an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, or when Sun Microsystems was being acquired by Oracle that weekend, the set of calls between the CEO of Oracle, the CEO of Sun, and their chief lawyers, and then back between them, and so on and so forth. If all you knew was the pattern of the calls, and you didn't know anything else, you didn't know the content, you would still know by Sunday evening that an acquisition was happening.
So I'm trying to put together a picture of what the government can know about us simply from having this cell phone metadata. They can tell where we are physically and in time. What else?
They can tell what we're doing. The example I gave you of the CEOs of Oracle and Sun.
Mm-hmm.
So metadata reveals what you do as opposed to what you say. And what you do is often much more revelatory.
Do we have any idea how the government is assessing and using this information? Because some of the examples that you gave, you know, the government probably doesn't really care.
No, we don't. And that's one of the problems. In standard Title III wiretaps, that is the wiretaps for criminal cases, there's something called minimization, where what you're allowed to do, you have a court order for wiretapping, but if it is not the target on the call, so this is in the model of the old telephone, and the old family telephone, if it's not the target on the call, but in fact one of their kids, the law enforcement officer has to shut off the tap. She can turn it back on a few minutes later. If it's the target talking, but the target is talking about going out and buying flowers for his wife, unless you think that's code for something else, you have to actually shut off the tap again, and then you can turn it on a few minutes later. That process is known as minimization. Now, what we don't know are the minimization rules that the government has used on the metadata. And that's quite troubling. The director of the NSA has said, we can't reveal that information because to do so would expose our sources and methods, would allow the terrorists to do other kinds of behavior and thwart us and so on. But it's not exactly true that that information can't be revealed. We can learn general rules without learning specific rules. So, for example, would it be acceptable if the NSA realized that terrorist cells had a certain calling pattern, a very small group with one person calling back to Pakistan, say, once a month or once every 2 months or at irregular intervals? Does that mean that they could search the database for that kind of group? I'm not asking for the particular rules, but I'm asking for a general overview of the rules. What we've gotten into is a situation in which we had a secret interpretation of the law, and then we have no idea what collection is actually happening.
I guess I'm wondering if the potential payoff in terms of catching possible terrorists isn't worth annoying people because, I don't know, their Amazon purchases can be seen.
So, the question often comes up that Google and Amazon and Facebook already have this information. What's the problem if the government gets it? And there are two different sets of problems. The first one is, of course, that Amazon and Google and Facebook can't throw you in jail and the government can. And we don't know if the government will really limit the investigations to terrorist cases. We have a situation where we've had no oversight. It's clear that a number of members of Congress are somewhat surprised by the data collection that has been happening. Certainly the American public, at least some parts of the American public, are surprised by it. So we don't have oversight, and we don't have guarantees that we won't have a slippery slope where this information won't be used for other things.
Can you think of any situations in which an innocent person could actually be harmed in some way by the kind of federal surveillance we're talking about?
Do we know of people who have been followed or arrested because of the wiretaps? No, we don't. But we don't know what drives the suspicions of the government. We have a huge number of people on watch lists, and it's hard to imagine that the FBI can do a good job investigating when they have so many people to watch. What we need is more targeted surveillance rather than the broad scale.
Mm. Has the legality of collecting this kind of metadata been established? Because one reason this issue blew up, I think, is that it seems like something has become routine practice without there having been a whole lot of public discussion or input. You referred to this as a secret interpretation of the law. How did this happen?
Beats me. How did it happen? Section 215 of the Patriot Act allowed the government to collect business records. Under the secret interpretation, the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, an FBI application that Verizon Business Networks and presumably other telcos hand over their metadata on a daily basis. And the FISA court so ordered, and the companies did so. And of course, the companies were not allowed to reveal that this was going on. Senator Wyden and one other senator demanded 2 years ago, to no avail, that this secret interpretation be made public. But without Snowden's release of the documents, that couldn't happen. And so there was no public discussion. I don't understand how you can have a secret interpretation of a law within a democracy. So that's how it happened. And now what we have to have are two different discussions, it seems to me, on this issue. One is, how could we have a secret interpretation of a law?
Right.
And that seems to me to call for a church committee type investigation. Church committee was the committee back in the 1970s that was chartered originally as a result of the Nixon wiretapping, but whose charter was actually to investigate government surveillance. The Church Committee investigation discovered all sorts of illegal things that the government had been doing. It framed a set of proposals that eventually became our Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The second thing is we need to have a public discussion of whether or not we want that metadata handed over to the government sans subpoena.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for that, the scientists and engineers are going to have to be somewhat involved because most people don't think about how easily they attract and what that information gives.
To that issue of whether or not we need computer scientists much more involved, it's interesting that when we talked with Julian Assange, he said that the next generation of whistleblowers will have to be computer scientists. Is that really what we're going to need to protect our privacy rights if we gotten to the point where ordinary people will have a hard time even figuring out the issues?
It's not so much that. I think the fact that it's so hard to do anything in secret and live in the modern world. So one thing you could do is try to shut off your cell phone. But that doesn't always work. The French police, for example, use the following technique in doing investigations. When they're checking who might have used a stolen credit card, the criminal, of course, knows to not have his cell phone on at the time that he's using the card, and so he shuts it off sometime before. But the French police do one step better. They actually get the records of which cell phones were shut off in an area physically close to the use of the stolen credit card for some time before the card was used. So shutting off your cell phone may not actually provide you the privacy you think. Now, if you're using a stolen credit card, that's one thing. But if you're a journalist trying to meet a source, that's a very different thing. And mm-hmm. I think it's gotten quite hard.
Don't you think that our expectation of personal privacy has changed over the past decade to the point that, I mean, I wonder whether people really care anymore?
We have changed in a number of ways. I expect us to use cell phones and lose the privacy of where we are. At least the cell phone provider will know, depending on what we decide. Maybe the government will only be able to get that information under subpoena. Maybe it will be able to get it more readily. But what I'm hearing from some of my colleagues who work in online social networks is that there is a slow but clear interest of the young people to not give as much information over to Facebook. Mm. And I think that we're in the very early stage of the social networks. I think we'll find people changing some from where they were 5 years ago, which is not to say that we will go back to where we were 30 years ago. I don't expect that. But I think where we were in the last 5-7 years is not going to be the steady point. I think we will move to somewhat more privacy.
You mentioned that you think that we need to have another church committee investigation. What are some of the top questions you'd want on the agenda?
So I would certainly want to know how there can be a secret interpretation of the law. That's, to me, a constitutional issue. And I want to understand when oversight was going on. My understanding that one of the problems on conducting oversight of NSA and other agencies is that on the very delicate stuff, the senators, the congresspeople, are only allowed in by themselves, no paper, no notes, no written questions by their staff. The result is when you're talking about stuff that's highly technical, often the people who are conducting the oversight don't have the ability to ask exactly the right question. And I think that we both potentially have a problem that when you get read into a top secret issue, you have a tendency not to ask questions. But I think of our senators and our congresspeople is generally trying to do the right job. But the more worrisome problem is that there are highly technical issues, and yet they're not accompanied by the people who can help them ask those questions. So understanding what the oversight is, has been, and what it needs to be. Then I want to know about how was this data handled? What were the checks and balances? Also, there's the issue of the whole surveillance industrial complex. I know a lot of people from NSA, a lot of ex-NSA people, and I have a lot of respect for them. I have a lot of respect for the work they do and for their integrity. And I know that they are sworn in their job to uphold the Constitution, and that's something that they're told very clearly. I don't know and I don't understand the surveillance industrial complex nearly as well. I don't know what the motivations are, and I don't think we have necessarily the people doing the job with the same dedication and care as is done at the NSA. Now, I'm saying that at the same time that I'm complaining about a secret interpretation of the law and the work done by NSA. But those are separate issues.
Right. One thing we could point out, on the other hand, is that the intelligence agencies are trying to do their job. They're trying to gather intelligence about possible threats to American citizens. And historically, when intelligence services, as they do, get a little overenthusiastic, we look to elected officials and to civil rights groups to keep them in check. How is that historic counterbalance working right now?
Well, we've already discussed the elected officials. As for the civil liberties groups, you can't litigate what you're not allowed to know about. And the ACLU, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, these groups have been repeatedly told they don't have standing. They can't point to a particular person who was harmed because they're not allowed to know whose data was taken, whose data was viewed, sans subpoena, sans warrant. They've been trying very hard, but they simply haven't been, had standing, and they've had minimal successes in all of this. So we haven't had the checks and balances that we ought to have had. And that's part of the reason that I and others are asking for a church-style committee investigation. It was when the news broke, I was at the Privacy Legal Scholars Conference, so there were a large number of people interested in this issue. And 201, everybody I spoke to said church-style committee hearing, because it's Congress that can get at the data in a way that the civil liberties groups and investigative reporters don't have the same capability.
Susan Landau is a former Sun Microsystems engineer and has held visiting posts at Harvard, Cornell, and Yale. Her latest book is called Surveillance or Security: The Risks Posed by New Wiretapping Technologies. You can hear an extended version of Anne's conversation with her on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've all been following the stories about Edward Snowden, about Hong Kong and Hawaii, wiretaps and leaks. But for all the recent Hollywood-worthy drama, just how new is this story really? I mean, after all, the media have been covering the NSA's surveillance programs for years. In 2005, New York Times journalists James Risen and Eric Lischblau published a series of articles about the surveillance without warrants of some Americans' international phone calls and emails. They won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting. In 2008, Steve asked Lischblau just how secret the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program had been.
This was probably the most secretive program in the Bush administration. The White House itself has acknowledged that, and I think that's the main reason that the White House fought so hard to keep it secret once we in the New York Times found out about it in 2004.
So you're saying that even a lot of people in government, maybe even in the Bush administration itself, did not know about this program?
Absolutely, and that's one issue that I get into in some detail in the book, is the idea that there were people with the highest security clearance in the government who did not know about this program, and that caused a good deal of angst and tumult within the administration. Within the FBI, there were agents and senior officials who stumbled onto the program within about 12 hours of its inception in October 2001, and it caused a brief but pretty anxiety-producing firestorm within the FBI because people were quite worried that the NSA was potentially breaking the law. You know, the NSA traditionally and legally was not allowed to target Americans in wiretapping, and it was soon clear at the FBI that that was exactly what the NSA was doing.
Now, presumably, if there is a government agency that is going to be looking for terrorists in the United States, you would think that would be the FBI, right? I mean, I guess it raises the question of why was the NSA even conducting these wiretaps?
Exactly. I mean, traditionally, that would have been the FBI's domain, and that's part of the reason why that caused such an early firestorm at the FBI, because the NSA was not in the business of targeting Americans. And this was a radical departure from past practice. I think the explanation for that is that the NSA had the hardware. The NSA had the spy satellites to make this happen, and the FBI did not. And the administration, particularly Cheney's office, realized that and wanted to utilize that. And, you know, that's in some ways quite an understandable conclusion. The way they went about that was in some ways, though, quite questionable because the usual checks and balances were ignored in large part.
So this wiretapping program was basically initiated out of Dick Cheney's office.
I mean,
they were the ones who were directing this whole operation.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a Dick Cheney operation from the start. It was Cheney who went to George Tenet at the CIA and went to Mike Hayden at the NSA and said, what more can the NSA be doing? The answer that he got was that given the current state of the law, there was nothing more, that the NSA's role had to stop essentially at the border when it came to targeting Americans. Once the program was authorized by the president, Cheney pushed for the incredible secrecy that surrounded this, limiting the congressional briefings in a way that some lawmakers now believe violated the law by excluding members of the intelligence committees. So this was Cheney's baby from the start.
Well, it's striking reading your book that there were some very high-placed government officials who questioned this wiretapping program. Larry Thompson, the Deputy Attorney General, the head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tell the story in the book on the very day of 9/11 of Jim Ziegler, the head of INS, sitting at the FBI's Emergency Command Center and questioning quite aggressively the policies that some of Ashcroft's advisors were about to embark on in terms of questioning, doing door-to-door questioning of Muslim neighborhoods, what he saw as sweeps of Muslim neighborhoods like in Dearborn, Michigan, for instance, and even searches. And Ziegler, you know, stood up and said that the INS would not be part of this, that he saw this as unconstitutional. He saw this as something close to what the British had done to colonial America in terms of warrantless searches, and he would not be a part of it. So that, you know, from literally the first few hours, there was this instant tension between the threat of 9/11 and kind of the due process that we had come to expect.
This story is fascinating on a number of fronts. One is that you and your fellow investigative reporter, Jim Risen at the New York Times, had this very explosive story, and then your newspaper sat on it for about a year or so. I mean, they didn't run this story. Why?
Well, I think you got to remember partly the time that we were in. This was in 2004. We were only at that point, you know, 2+ years out of 9/11. And the shadow of 9/11, I think, was still very powerful. And the administration made a strong and urgent plea that if this story were to run, it would do grave damage to national security. It would imperil a program that was vital to protecting the country and stopping another attack. And I think any responsible editor would certainly listen closely to arguments like that. I'm not sure in that climate back in 2004 that any major paper would have run that story. You know, certainly as reporters, you know, reporters are usually the first ones to say, oh, run the story. You know, it's not our names that are on the masthead. And the editors have a different responsibility than we do as reporters. And the editors felt differently.
Well, didn't President Bush himself essentially threaten the New York Times and say, look, if you run this story and there's another big terrorist attack on American soil, you, the New York Times, will have blood on your hands.
Yeah, that was the message. That was the message that was given to our publisher and our editor in the final plea not to run the story in December of 2005. The idea that if there is another attack, the New York Times will be sitting next to the administration in front of Congress explaining, how did this happen? There'll be blood on your hands.
That's pretty chilling.
Oh, it's,
if you're the publisher and you're the editor, you got to think long and hard about that.
It's absolutely chilling. I think it would be irresponsible for any editor to ignore a plea like that. Absolutely.
Now, the larger question about all of this is, how much the public has a right to know about what the government is doing. And to some degree, I think partly your argument is investigative reporters are stand-ins for the public. I mean, that's how we're going to find out about a lot of this stuff.
Sure.
Where do you come down on that? I mean, what we should know about what our government is doing?
Well, you know, I think that there are certainly limits. I'm not one of these people out there who thinks that the public has to know everything the government is doing, that there can't be anything, that, you know, the government is an open book. There are several programs that in our reporting we have come across, several secret programs that we simply stopped reporting because we thought this is something that crosses the line. There's a clear national security interest, and whatever the public interest in is fairly minimal. So we said, you know what, this is not even worth pursuing. So, you know, whereas our critics say, oh, the New York Times will print anything, I think if they knew how our jobs work, they would realize that wasn't true. But at the same time, I do hold the view that, you know, public scrutiny is an antiseptic that can often prevent a lot of the problems that come up later, and that, you know, the Fourth Estate does have an important role to play in exposing problems. I mean, that's been a fundamental pillar of our country.
That was New York Times journalist Eric Lischblau in 2008 telling Steve Paulson about his coverage of the NSA's wiretapping program.
There's a spy by my window. I know it's you. You like to keep an eye on me. I know you like to keep an eye on me.
One of the questions people keep asking these days is whether more privacy is worth less security. There have been at least three public opinion surveys on the question in the past month, and Americans seem pretty split on the issue. Shane Harris says that cyber sleuthing is real and powerful, particularly when it happens between governments and corporations. Harris wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. In 2011, Steve asked him just how many Americans' communications are being watched.
I think it's a lot of people. I mean, to draw the lines, I mean, there are certainly more non-Americans who are being watched than Americans. The law does not permit the intelligence community or the FBI or any agency of government to monitor the phone calls, emails, and other content of communications of Americans without a warrant. They have to get permission from a court to do that. But what is going on a much more meta level, if you like, is the government is monitoring traffic patterns of communication. They are monitoring phone records without monitoring the content. They're looking at information coming into and out of the United States on the internet. At the same time, you know, the counter to this is that, you know, the chances are probably pretty good that if you're minding your business, if you're not engaged in trying to plan an act of terrorism, the intelligence community is probably not that interested in your phone calls and your emails because, frankly, they have a lot of them to get through. I think that's sort of thin reassurance for a lot of people, and me included, because you can see how the surveillance state over time keeps growing. It is the government's instinct to keep trying to consume more and more information, and very little attention is paid to how it's used. And I really, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was I wanted people to start thinking about the consequences of this kind of collection, not just, you know, from the, you know, the sort of obvious concerns about freedom of speech and curtailing rights, but do we really want to have a government that's consuming all of this information without knowing how it's being used and if it's even being used effectively?
Now, there is danger of possible attacks on the United States operating on at least a couple of levels. There are the rogue terrorists who try to blow up planes. There are also sophisticated foreign hackers who are trying to get into the Pentagon's computer network, which potentially could be a whole lot more dangerous. What's happening there?
This is really the next frontier in surveillance. It's the realm of cyberspace. And what we've seen in the past 2 or 3 years is a dramatic increase in the number of attempted penetrations and successful penetrations of government, military, and also corporate networks. Google announced that its corporate network was penetrated by hackers who were able to steal some of its intellectual property, its sort of secret sauce of how it does Google. It was a really extraordinary admission because very few companies ever come forward and talk about this kind of thing. But it's happening all the time. It's happening every day. Secrets are being stolen. Power grids are being probed.
Wasn't there a case back in 2007 when there's a good deal of evidence that the Chinese military actually did hack into Pentagon computers?
Yeah, I mean, we've had evidence that secret networks even in the Central Command, for instance, the U.S., the military Central Command, some foreign unknown entity penetrated those networks as well, which was quite a feat considering they're not actually connected to the public internet, which means that somebody somehow got something inside the room where these computers are contained and managed to load it into the network. So we know this is happening. It's been sort of a, we'll look the other way, maybe. We don't want to say out loud officially that we know it's China or that the Russians are doing this, but everyone knows it.
So I have to ask, are there comparable efforts by the U.S. government to hack into, let's say, Chinese and Russian computer networks?
There are. They're being kept, I think, very secret right now because of the obvious implication that I don't think we want to start a cyber arms race. But the government has been pretty public in its establishment of something new at the Defense Department, what they call Cyber Command. And this would be a place that would have responsibility for defense of military networks, but also the place where we would essentially launch a response or an attack, even if we did it preemptively, on another network. And we have had limited instances of cyber attack in warfare. In 2007, the NSA, under the authorization of President Bush and actually at Mike McConnell's urging, launched a very targeted, sophisticated cyber attack on the cell phones that were being used by Iraqi insurgents, particularly the ones who were planting IEDs, roadside bombs, and were really racking up tremendous casualties.
Did that work in Iraq against the insurgents?
You know, people who I've talked to about this says it actually was quite effective. And this kind of intelligence effort, coupled with the better information we were getting from human sources on the ground and from predator drones in the air and surveillance aircraft, people say that this cyber intelligence actually was more useful than the actual troop surge in actually turning the advantage back to the Americans. So people have a lot of faith in this, and they've seen it do really tremendous kind of, you know, wow sort of things. And I think rightly see it as the future of warfare, or certainly a major component of warfare in the future.
But this is also really serious. I mean, if we're talking about actually using this technology as a weapon to create cyber weapons, in fact, you say that any use of cyber weapons requires authorization of the president. Basically, they are treated as if they are nuclear weapons.
That's right. They're treated as strategic weapons the same way we treat the nuclear arsenal. And the reason for that sort of underscores the potency of these cyber weapons. If we release a computer virus, let's say, against an adversary's financial system to try and knock out the banking system and cripple it, what's to say that that virus couldn't quickly replicate itself and spread through the network, through the internet, to which those financial networks are connected, and knock out the banks of an allied country? What's to say it couldn't even blow back on us? I mean, it really underscores the way in which modern communication systems connected to the internet are completely interconnected, and so much of that traffic moves through the United States. If you lay out a map of kind of the internet backbone, if you like, and you look at the United States in the center of that map, it looks like a heart with arteries and valves coming in and out. I mean, most of the physical pipes that move traffic on the internet come into and out of the United States. So when we attack overseas, it may be the other side of the world, but it can, in a millisecond, bounce back on us if we're not careful.
So is this the future of warfare, that the decisive battles will be fought in cyberspace?
I think that's a real possibility. I think the notion that we would somehow destroy the physical world through the exchange of nuclear weapons at this point seems preposterous. I suppose it's still a real threat. But countries are pursuing weapons in cyberspace, and there are no treaties governing their use. There's no real understanding of what the laws of war are. But no one, the United States included, is sitting back and letting the other guy get the upper hand. There is an arms race in cyberspace.
Well, this is all very frightening, I have to say. I mean, the threats out there are real, and yet they're also tremendous risks that we are starting to live in a surveillance state, that there are all these people out there who are monitoring everything that we do. And I guess it raises the question, is anyone watching the watchers?
You know, that's, I think, the real key question. And unfortunately, I find that the answer is not really. There's a trade-off to be had here. On the one hand, we live in a world where people try and carry bombs onto airplanes and where governments try and break into computer systems and probe electrical grids, and that's a threat, and it's real. And on the other hand, we have this system in place that is trying to ward against those attacks. And to do that, they have to consume a lot of information and watch a lot of people. In order to be effective, there has to be a real understanding and a lot of hard and fast rules for how they go about doing that job. And in the United States, over the past 25, 30 years, which is the span of the book, really, we have focused all of our attentions, almost all of our attentions, on the front end. What are the rules for collecting the information? Who can you collect on? Under what circumstances can you collect it? And the law has pretty much settled that issue to the point where now the government, for practical purposes, can watch whoever it wants, whenever it needs to watch. So we haven't really paid any of this attention to who's watching the watchers, both to make sure that they're not going over the line and that they're actually using this information in a smart way. And I think that's where the conversation has to go now. It falls to the Obama administration to do this. It's not going to be a congressional prescription here. This is going to depend on the government setting up rules, hopefully transparent, for how it uses this information, knowing that information is just the currency of war and security and life as we know it now.
That's Shane Harris talking with Steve Paulson back in 2011. Harris wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. I'm Tim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. When the latest news broke about the NSA's surveillance of Americans' communications, sales of George Orwell's 1984 went through the roof. In that classic, protagonist Winston Smith defies state control by having a love affair and, basically, thinking rebellious thoughts. What would defying state control look like in 2013? Writer and digital activist Cory Doctorow considered the question in his novel Little Brother.
They set up a little screen at the end of the truck, and they came for us, one at a time, unshackling us and leading us to the back of the truck. I was third, brought back by the woman with a severe haircut. They had a little table between them with the contents of my wallet and my backpack spread out on it. "Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "We have some questions for you." "Am I under arrest?" I asked. This wasn't an idle question. If you're not under arrest, there are limits on what the cops can and can't do to you. "What's this for?" she said, holding up my phone. "Am I under arrest?" I repeated. "You're being detained by the Department of Homeland Security," the woman snapped. "You think I'm a terrorist? I'm 17 years old." "Just the right age. Al-Qaeda loves recruiting impressionable young idealistic kids. Now, I want you to unlock this phone and decrypt the files in its memory. I want you to account for yourself. Why were you out on the street? What do you know about the attack on this city?" "I'm not going to unlock my phone for you," I said indignantly. "My phone's memory has all kinds of private stuff on it. Photos, emails, little hacks and mods I've installed. In hindsight, maybe I should have unlocked my phone for them."
Little Brother is a tale of techno-geek rebellion.
This is a book about some friends who are, you know, clever, techie, creative kids who are out in San Francisco one day skipping school and playing a kind of scavenger hunt called an alternate reality game where you go around and try and find clues. And someone blows up the Bay Bridge. And they can't really explain to the Department of Homeland Security, who pick them up as they swarm the city in the wake of this terrible disaster, they can't really explain to them what they're doing. Because first of all, you know, scavenger hunt's just kind of a weird excuse for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And second of all, they're under the mistaken apprehension that they've been arrested by the police. And they do what you should do if you're arrested by the police. They say, "Am I under arrest? If I am, give me a lawyer." And they just keep repeating that to the great anger of the authoritarians who've picked them up, to the point where they're not just released as harmless kids, but rather taken in and very intensively and abusively questioned. One of them isn't released at all. And when they get back onto the street again, they find San Francisco in a kind of police state lockdown. And based on that radicalizing experience, they decide that they're going to declare war on the Department of Homeland Security if that's what it takes to bring the Bill of Rights back to America.
Now, were there any particular events or, say, newspaper headlines or anything you read that inspired this book?
The thing that really got me going here, the two things that got me going anyway, the first one is that if you're a young person today, you may not have the experience that I did when I was, you know, 8 years old. My dad brought home a computer, which was the experience that I suddenly found in technology, a tool for empowering myself, getting more control over my life, all these great networks and tools and ideas. You might see computers and technology as tools for following you around and snitching on you and controlling you, because that's what young person's technology is often about today, you know, whether it's the spyware on a school network that's monitoring every click and sending it to some, you know, sleazy company that's supposed to be keeping kids safe from bad things, or mobile phones that let your parents follow you around town. So I really wanted to show kids that they could use technology to gain more freedom.
Mm. The action in the book takes place in the not very far distant future. The high school students are being spied on by school authorities all the time in a way that you're suggesting really isn't all that different from today.
Sure. I mean, there's schools in Texas that are putting felon tracking anklets on kids who are truant. And actually, the life cycle of surveillance and control technology, it moves through populations that have less agency or less political juice and kind of is staged up to more and more general populations. So, you know, first we try out things like CCTVs or tracker bracelets on paroled felons and prisoners and mental patients. And then once we work some kinks out of them, you know, they're the first kind of, they're the alpha testers. We move to the beta testers, who are people like kids. And then we move to the general population. You know, we go in software terms, we ship the gold master. And the gold master is what we have now in London, for example, with surveillance technology, where we have cameras on every corner. Your Oyster card reads your every transit ride and can be linked back to you and can track your movements around town. Every license plate is photographed at almost every intersection. I think that kids really are the beta testers of the surveillance society. So it behooves us all to pay attention to what's going on with them and also to get them mobilized about it.
The important thing about security systems isn't how they work, it's how they fail. That was the first line of my first blog post on Open Revolt, my ex-net site. I was writing as M1K3Y, Mikey, and I was ready to go to war.
What do the kids in your book wind up doing about it? How do they resist or rebel?
Well, they build a lot of technology. In fact, it's not so much that they build technology as they repurpose technology in the grand tradition of the great hardware and software hackers who have taken as their motto, if you can't open it, you don't own it, that real Yankee ingenuity sensibility that says, you know, when you've got a computer, you need to get under the hood and figure out how to get it to dance to your will. And so they start by taking these Xboxes that everyone has lying around, and they figure out how to jailbreak these Xboxes so they can load their own operating system, their own software on it. And then they use that to build a cryptographically secured wireless network that spans San Francisco and that incorporates social media, games, and also message boards and organizational tools. And they use this to organize citywide civil disobedience, free concerts in the park, jamming surveillance technology. They build readers that can read people's contactless cards, like their contactless keys, their contactless ID, like the RFID chips that we see in passports and so on. So they build readers and writers, and they bump into people and they read all the numbers off of their cards, and they bump into someone else and they write the numbers to those cards so that everyone's identity gets mixed up and all the statistical stuff for figuring out who's being a naughty person gets totally confounded.
I was cautious and conservative compared to a lot of ex-netters. A couple of girls in the chemical engineering program at UC Berkeley, they figured out how to make a harmless substance out of kitchen products that would trip off explosive sniffers. They had a merry time sprinkling it on their profs' briefcases and jackets. Then, they'd hide out and watch the same profs try to get into the auditoriums and libraries on campus, only to get flying tackled by the new security squads that had sprung up everywhere. I passed by San Francisco General Hospital and nodded with satisfaction as I saw the huge lines at the front doors. They had a police checkpoint too, of course, and there were enough ex-netters working there that everyone's badges had been snarled up and swapped around. I read the security checks had tacked an hour onto everyone's workday, and the unions were threatening to walk out unless the hospitals did something about it. I headed home the long way, circling through the Mission to see the havoc. Long lines of cars, BART stations lined up around the blocks, people swearing at ATMs that wouldn't dispense their money because they had their accounts frozen for suspicious activity. I got home and made myself a sandwich and logged onto the XNet. It had been a good day. People from all over town were crowing about their successes. We had brought the city of San Francisco to a standstill. The news reports confirmed it. They were calling it the DHS gone haywire, blaming it all on the fake security that was supposed to be protecting us from terrorism. According to the Chronicle's Economist, a week of this crap would cost the city more than the Bay Bridge bombing had.
Do you think of this as a subversive book?
Yeah, and I think technology is subversive in as much as technology generally gives the advantage to people who want to disrupt the status quo over people who want to defend it. Because defending something requires that you not have any vulnerabilities, and attacking something requires that you find a vulnerability. So I think that technology always subverts whatever the status quo is, for good and ill. Sometimes the status quo is that we have a lot of personal liberty, and then technology figures out how to subvert that, right? I mean, the Stasi, for all their invasive surveillance, these are the secret police in East Germany, were severely limited by technology. They just couldn't surveil as well as they wanted to. The NSA was able to totally disrupt that status quo when they went into AT&T's data centers, like the one on Folsom Street in San Francisco, and installed beam splitters on the fiber optic lines and illegally wiretapped an entire nation. So yeah, technology always subverts. Technology always disrupts.
I guess I'm curious about, you know, since your book has been out for a year now, have there been adults who've read the book who've been critical of it, who've said, you know, wait, 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 you're giving kids entirely the wrong message. They're resisting the Department of Homeland Security, and you're teaching them to undermine school authorities, and we don't want our kids reading this book.
Well, don't I wish? I mean, wouldn't that be a lovely controversy to drum up readers? No, it turns out the only criticism that it's drawn from grown-ups, as near as I can work out, is that they don't like that about three-quarters of the way through the book, there's a scene in which two 17-year-olds who have a long-term committed relationship have safe sex. Not like graphic safe sex, like they decide to have sex, and then the chapter ends. And this has been like a source of enormous controversy among certain grown-ups. And to a lesser extent, I have been questioned by grown-ups about the fact that there's a scene where the kids drink beer, there's a scene where the kids talk about smoking marijuana and its derivatives, and there's a couple of scenes where they just sort of sass grown-ups generally. And it turns out that, like, sassing grown-ups, having a beer, or having safe sex at 17 is way, way, way more disruptive in adults' minds than, like, overthrowing the American government.
That's digital activist and writer Cory Doctorow talking about his novel, Little Brother. He talked with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Who's Afraid of Big Brother? To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Doug Gordon, Anne Strangechamps, and Charles Monroe Kane, with audio ingenuity by Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
Public Radio International.